This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, November 18th, 2009. From New York City, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up on today's newscast, Attorney General Eric Holder defends plans to try Guantanamo detainees in civilian courts.
The venue in which we are most likely to obtain justice for the American people is in federal court.
The moment the person is in the hands of the United States government, they're entitled to be told they have a right to a lawyer and can remain silent. And if we go down that road, we're going to make this country less safe.
The UN Summit on Food wraps up today in Rome without promises of funding to fight hunger.
The direction which agriculture is taking has, in fact, increased hunger, and we need to change direction.
And we'll go to East Jerusalem, where the Israeli government is building new settlements and evicting Palestinian families.
They smash the windows open, they force their way into the house, and within less than a minute, everyone was outside.
Those stories and more right after the headlines.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. After weeks of hedging, Iran announced today it would not send its nuclear material abroad for processing. Iran, Russia, France, and the United States had come to a preliminary agreement to allow the country to develop its nuclear capabilities for medical and research purposes while assuaging fears of weapons development. Today, Iran's foreign minister said the country would be amenable to a nuclear material swap within its borders. It's unclear whether the other negotiating countries will accept this alternative. In other news from Iran, the country's judicial system has sentenced five more protesters to death for their role in the post-election demonstrations. At least three others have been similarly sentenced. U.S. states have taken it upon themselves to recognize or prohibit same-sex marriage. A similar scenario has been playing out in Mexico, but with the issue of abortion. Shannon Young has more.
The state legislature of Veracruz passed a measure Tuesday evening to reform its constitution in order to grant legal guarantees to life, quote, from conception until natural death. A majority of legislators also approved a change to the state's penal code so that any woman found guilty of an abortion has to undergo mandatory psychological counseling and pay a fine. Repeat offenders will be subject to 1 to 4 years in prison. Veracruz is the 17th state to pass anti-abortion measures since a 2008 decision by Mexico's Supreme Court determined that states can make their own laws on the issue. Mexico City is the only place in the country where first trimester abortions are available without legal conditions. In addition to the reforms passed Tuesday, the state legislature of Veracruz decided to send a recommendation to Mexico's Congress, urging it to include a similar amendment in the federal constitution. Shannon Young, FSRN, Mexico.
U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton made an unannounced visit to Afghanistan today, ahead of tomorrow's inauguration of President Hamid Karzai. There, she called on the war-torn country to fight corruption and restore the people's trust in the government. Earlier this week, the NGO Transparency International released a report naming Afghanistan the second most corrupt country in the world, behind only Somalia. Iraqi parliamentary elections, scheduled for this January, could be delayed after the country's vice president vetoed part of the recently passed elections legislation. Sunni VP Tariq al-Hashimi is calling for Iraqis living abroad, a large number of whom are Sunni, to have a larger stake in the government. Shiite Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki is calling the veto a, quote, threat to the political process. The Iraqi parliament had worked for months to hash out the highly controversial election legislation. Kurdish officials have also taken umbrage with a lack of representation in the proposed parliament, saying yesterday they will boycott the vote if not allotted more seats. Commuters in the Romanian capital are making alternate transportation plans as the city's subway workers strike. And although a Romanian court has now ordered the workers back to their posts, the general unrest in the country seems likely to continue as this Sunday's election day approaches. FSRN's Donna Lepidot reports from Bucharest.
The tube hasn't run here for 2 days now, as employees of the Metrorex company strike over salary disputes. The strike has forced an estimated 600,000 commuters to use buses and their own cars, which has created traffic jams all over the city. The workers are striking because, according to the law, they should have been given a rise on November 15th. Despite this, a Romanian court ruled today that the strike is illegal and ordered the Metrorex employees back to work. Romania is currently functioning without a formal government, and budget legislation has been pushed aside as political issues are resolved. Dana Lepodat, FSRN, Bucharest.
And finally, an ethics panel in South Carolina today is considering if there is enough evidence to impeach Republican Governor Mark Sanford. Sanford is accused of using government funds and transportation for personal and political reasons. The movement to impeach Sanford has so far only received lukewarm support within the state's Republican-controlled legislature, although the state's Republican Party has voted to censure the governor. And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
This is Dorian Marina in New York. Attorney General Eric Holder appeared before a Senate hearing today. Hostile senators pressed him on concerns about trying Guantanamo detainees in civilian courts. He assured the Senate that the courts are the appropriate place to try Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who is accused of planning the 9/11 attacks, as well as four other detainees. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports.
One day after the Senate voted to allow the transfer of detainees to the U.S., Attorney General Eric Holder sat in the hot seat before the Senate Judiciary Committee. He defended his decision to use the U.S. court system for detainees.
It was clear to me that the venue in which we are most likely to obtain justice for the American people is in federal court.
Last Friday, Holder announced that of the more than 200 detainees remaining at Guantanamo Bay, five, including Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, would receive a trial in federal court in New York City, while five others, including Abdalrahim Nashiri, the alleged bomber of the USS Cole battleship, will be tried in a military commission. Both are considered high-value detainees and declassified material reveals that both have been waterboarded at Guantanamo. Holder said he followed a strict protocol that looked at admission of evidence, sentencing procedure, and nature of the crime to determine if the detainees would be tried in military commissions or federal court. While Democrats defended Holder's decision, Republicans shot back. John Kyle of Arizona said, Holder appears to be making his decision based on, quote, subjective judgment.
It's hard to understand a rationale, though, that when you kill 3,000 almost civilians, that therefore calls for Article 3 as opposed to military commission. The logic of that escapes me.
Republican Lindsey Graham of South Carolina told Holder that his move is a, quote, perversion of justice. Graham said military commission rules are more lenient.
You can have military operations, you can interrogate somebody for military intelligence purposes, and the law enforcement rights do not attach. But under domestic criminal law, the moment the person is in the hands of the United States government, they're entitled to be told they have a right to a lawyer and can remain silent. And if we go down that road, we're going to make this country less safe.
But Holder assures lawmakers of prosecution.
We should use all the tools available to us. Military courts, Article 3 courts.
Holder said more than 300 accused terrorists are being held in U.S. prisons and that the U.S. courts have tried more than 150 people on terrorism-related charges. Because of delays and the struggle of setting up a new justice system, the military commission has only tried three people. Two of the three have already served their sentences and been released. The military commission system is currently hearing the case of one detainee. Jamil Dakwar, legal director of the American Civil Liberties Union, criticizes Holder as well. He prefers that all cases move through the federal courts.
We're concerned that the decision was not uniform. It was split between using existing military commissions as well as the federal courts. And I think that creates problems in the future where the military commissions are actually second-class a system of justice that lacks, again, the legitimacy of the federal courts.
Holder also said the detainees moving through the court system could be detained indefinitely, even if the court dismisses his case or is found not guilty. Holder also said Guantanamo will not close in January, which Obama pledged last year. Leanne Caldwell, FSRN, Washington, D.C.
A federal commission that was responsible for the Civil and Voting Rights Acts of the 1960s is under fire. A coalition of public interest groups headed by the ACLU says the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights has become harmfully politicized and can no longer fulfill its duty as a guardian of human and civil rights. Today they told Congress that major reforms in the commission are needed. FSRN's Matt Pearson reports.
The U.S. Commission on Civil Rights had a hand in creating landmark legislation during the civil rights era, but the ACLU's Deborah Vagan says it's no longer protecting the rights of citizens.
Without them, we would not have had the Civil Rights Act of 1964 or the Voting Rights Act of 1965. Unfortunately, in recent times, it's really strayed from its mission.
Vagan says the commission has been unhelpful and sometimes even hostile towards civil rights protections in recent years.
You've seen them take antithetical positions antithetical to civil rights issues, including opposing reauthorization of the Voting Rights Act, including asking the ABA to delete its requirement that law schools demonstrate a commitment to diversity. They took no action after Hurricane Katrina or Gina 6, you know, two issues that of civil rights problems that really pierced the public consciousness, and they were absent.
The commission is made up of 8 appointees, each serving 6-year terms. Half of the appointees are chosen by the president, and the other half by Congress. There is currently no vetting process for candidates, which Vagan says is part of the problem. She says her group is recommending for Congress that commissioners undergo a confirmation process in the Senate, a lot like the process for nominees to the Supreme Court and other federal courts.
We really think that this will increase the transparency of the body and make the qualifications of those potential nominees public. I think there are possibly some commissioners now that would have not made it through that process because, you know, certainly we've got commissioners that are hostile to civil rights, but we also have some that have absolutely no civil rights experience whatsoever.
Vagan says the commission has become overly politicized as distrust between Democrats and Republicans over judicial nominations has grown. As with federal judges, partisan politics have determined the makeup of the commission in recent years. Currently, all 4 presidential nominees on the commission were appointed by George Bush. All 4 are Republicans. Michael O'Neill, professor of law at George Mason University and former head of the Senate Judiciary Committee, isn't sure the Civil Rights Commission has been adversely affected, but says the judicial branch has become a bigger factor in political campaigns in recent years.
I think you've seen, you know, at the presidential level, presidents both in campaigning and then once they, you know, get into office, having a particular view for the courts. And by them having a particular view for the courts or their vision of how they want justices to act, that necessarily politicizes the process of appointment. And obviously it causes, you know, the opposing party, whether it's the Republicans now and President Obama or the Democrats when they were fighting the Bush nominees, you know, to sort of view and scrutinize these people pretty carefully.
The coalition leadership will propose legislation to Congress for the commission's reform. Despite a busy legislative schedule in Congress, they say reforming the commission should be a priority. Matt Pearson, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
The UN Food Summit wraps up in Rome today. Leaders signed a declaration to end world hunger, but the meeting concludes without a firm commitment to fund the efforts. And critics say the meeting did little to address food pricing, agriculture development aid, or the effects that hunger has on women, all issues that are critical to confronting the needs of some 1 billion people who go hungry every night. Well, while the Food and Agriculture Organization meeting ran this week, a parallel meeting was taking place. That's the People's Food Sovereignty Forum. And it released a final declaration today that criticizes the failure of state leaders to come up with a meaningful response to hunger. FSRN's Dileta Varlisa has more from Rome.
The People's Food Sovereignty Forum brought together more than 600 people from 93 countries. It was an alternative conference as farmers weren't part of the official FAO summit. There are more than 1 billion small farmers worldwide. Janet Bergson is one of them.
We believe that the World Food Summit and the direction in which agriculture is taking has in fact increased hunger, and we need to change direction. And we're offering real solutions through our whole concept of food sovereignty, which focuses on food production that is local, that is small scale, appropriate to the ecological and cultural areas, peasant production agriculture, which will not only feed the world, but feed it better.
Small farmers want more control over land, water, seed, fisheries, and agriculture biodiversity, all needed to ensure food sovereignty. In a declaration issued at the close of their parallel summit, the People's Food Sovereignty Forum criticized FAO member states for failing to back commitments with funding and criticized the WTO for prioritizing commercial interests over the world's marginalized people. Smaller farmers from around the world are expected to attend the Copenhagen Climate Change meeting next month to continue to find solutions to the global food crisis. Diletta Varlese, FSRN, Rome.
And now we turn to an in-depth look at the Food Summit and what it means for efforts to confront hunger. We're joined now by Raj Patel. He's a fellow with Food First, a people's think tank on food in Oakland, California. He's also the author of the upcoming book, The Value of Nothing: How to Reshape Market Society and Redefine Democracy. Welcome to Free Speech Radio News.
It's good to be here.
Now, the summit began with great expectation on Monday. People talked about a goal to eradicate hunger worldwide by 2025, to secure more funding for agriculture aid. What are the results that you see now?
Very little. I mean, people are still saying, wouldn't it be nice to get rid of hunger by 2025? And the governments that have signed the declaration have unanimously agreed to stick to the goals that they had before they came into the conference, which is to halve hunger by 2015. But in terms of substantive commitments, very little has come out of the conference. The governments seem to be wedded to pretty much the same language and the same policies that they had when they went in.
Now, no other group of eight leader attended the summit besides Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi. Italy was the host of the summit. What does this say about the commitment of world leaders to ending hunger?
Well, that's it. I mean, I think that the absence of any rich country leaders spoke volumes about their commitment to eradicate hunger. Rich countries, and OECD countries in particular, spend billions of dollars a year on subsidizing their farmers and giving subsidies really not to small sustainable farmers, but to large agriculture and industrial agricultural interests to the tune of over $350 billion a year. Now, to eradicate world hunger would take, in the Food and Agriculture's estimation, Agriculture Organization's estimation, about $44 billion a year. So we spend $350 billion already, and that keeps the situation going as it is right now. But if we were to divert some of that funding towards the developing world, $44 billion a year would eradicate hunger by 2025.
The summit specifically identified the Horn of Africa as a critical region. There, 23 million people are short of food. Food Aid so far has focused on promoting a green revolution, increasing production with technology. Obama has said he'd like to bring that to Africa. Is this a good solution, and what other strategies could be necessary?
So the green revolution only sounds like a good idea if you don't really know what its full impact has been and what its full consequences are. It's true that African agricultural productivity is relatively low, but there are great ways of increasing that without resorting to profligate water use and hooking African agriculture into the pesticide treadmill. And one of the ways of doing that is through agroecological farming. It's a farming system that gives up on this idea of using a field as a factory, as a monoculture, and instead builds ecologies where the soil fertility gets built up over time, where you have beneficial insects being encouraged through the planting of certain kinds of crops, that you grow not only food to eat, but food for fuel and for fiber and for medicinal purposes as well. And you can do that with a much smaller resource footprint than the Green Revolution offers at the moment. And it offers the prospect of being much more robust in terms of climate change, much more frugal in terms of resources, much better for the environment, and much, you know, the source of much better nutrition for the people who eat the food off that land.
Were any of those strategies on the table in Rome?
No, in fact, there's been a really important report called the ICESTAT report. It's if people are interested, they can look it up by either Googling agriculture at a crossroads or visiting the report's website at agassessment.org. But basically, this was a report that had 400 of the world's top scientists asking the question, what will we do in 2050? And it was a report paid for in part by the United States and by Europe and by the World Bank, you know, very, very big institutions, very powerful institutions. And these scientists found that the way to feed the world would be to have agroecological farming and have a lot more decentralized farming systems, farming systems that are much closer to cities, that work within ecologies and that require cutting-edge science, but not the kind of science that the agricultural industry is providing. Now, that report is, you know, had been bought and paid for, and the results are well known, but no mention of it was made in the final report, in the final declaration from Rome that was signed today. Instead, the governments have sort of committed themselves to the same old business-as-usual policies and the same old promises. And, of course, the problem is hungry people can't eat promises.
We've been speaking with Raj Patel. He's a fellow with Food First, the Institute for Food and Development Policy. Thank you for joining us.
It's been a pleasure.
The Israeli government announced plans to construct an additional 900 housing units in East Jerusalem. Many are condemning the move, including UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, who said the move threatens Israeli-Palestinian peace talks. President Obama also criticized the announcement and told Fox News that, quote, additional settlement building does not contribute to Israel's security, but instead embitters the Palestinians in a way that could end up being very dangerous. State Department spokesperson Ian Kelly said the announcement comes at a sensitive time.
This is at a time when we're working to relaunch negotiations, and we believe that these actions make it more difficult for our efforts to succeed. So we object to this, and we object to other Israeli practices in Jerusalem related to housing, including the continuing pattern of evictions and demolitions of Palestinian homes.
To learn more about this issue, we go now to the East Jerusalem neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah, where more than 70 families are facing eviction notices to clear out their homes for Jewish settlers. It's the latest in a series of evictions targeting Palestinian families who've been living in the neighborhood for more than 5 decades. Israeli settlers claim the land is theirs and have already moved into 4 of the homes, leaving many Palestinian homeowners in Sheikh Jarrah concerned that they too will end up on the street. FSRN's Aya Batrari reports.
It happened really, really quickly. We thought that we were prepared for it, but I don't think there was any way to be prepared for what happened. It was very, very forceful. They smashed the windows open. They forced their way into the house. And within less than a minute, everyone was outside.
Sara Hawes is far from the chaos that ensued the night of August 2nd. Back in Cairo now, the Egyptian-American University student went to visit Palestinian families facing eviction in East Jerusalem. To her surprise, the eviction happened just before daybreak on the night of her visit. Another American who was with Hawes discreetly recorded the eviction on his mobile phone.
Thank you.
the Hanun family and the Ghawi family were thrown out of their homes that night. They became the latest two families in the East Jerusalem neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah to be forcibly evicted from their homes by Israeli police after having lived there for more than 50 years. The families have nowhere to go. They camp on the street and under trees just feet away from where they used to live. But these are no longer Palestinian homes. Israeli settlers have moved in. Khawla Hanun stands outside the door of what was her home, where now newly installed security cameras peer from overhead. She says that every time she sees settlers going in and out of her home, she dies inside. She asks, what right do they have to take her home, the home where her husband, her children were born? Just down the road, Nasser Ghawi expresses a similar sentiment. He and 36 members of his family had been living in their home since 1956. Across the street from the home where he used to live, his new dwelling has no roof and no door. He and the other members of his family, including his children, are living in a tent surrounded by some old mattresses and plastic chairs.
I'm feeling very, very bad, very hungry. I think I'm dying every day, maybe 100 times, when I'm seeing the settlers go in or out my house, and I cannot get to the door of my house. It's not fair.
But according to Israeli courts, this is fair. Israeli settlers have provided documents to the court which they say proves the land in East Jerusalem was bought by a settler organization in the 1800s when the land was under Ottoman rule. But Palestinians argue that the Turkish government has documents proving that when this land was under Ottoman rule, it was never sold to the Jewish organization in question. The international community considers East Jerusalem occupied land, and such settlement activity is considered illegal under international law. According to a report presented to Israeli parliamentarians last month, Israel has annexed almost 20,000 acres of land from Palestinian owners over the last 40 years. And since 1967, when Israel captured the city, around 50,000 housing units have been built with government assistance. It was also in that year that Jerusalem had some 66,000 Palestinian residents and only a few hundred Jewish residents. Today, there are nearly 500,000 Jews living in Jerusalem, nearly double the population of Palestinians. 20-year-old psychology major Sherihan Hanun says that she and her family are now homeless because of a wider Israeli policy to occupy all of Jerusalem. She says the court case in Sheikh Jarrah has little to do with proof of land ownership.
But they believe the Israeli, the judge is Israeli. How, like, the judge Israeli, he will help the Palestinian or the Israelian? He will help the Israelian.
So you don't think there's any way to get a fair trial?
No, I don't think so.
But when journalists try to approach the settlers to hear from them, no one answers the door.
It seems nobody wants to answer.
On the Palestinian side, it seems no one wants to answer either. According to Hatem Abu Ahmed, the pro bono lawyer defending the Palestinian residents of Sheikh Jarrah, a Palestinian Authority official in Jerusalem refused to provide funds for court fees. The official also asked him to stop working on the case altogether.
Unfortunately, I was prevented by a clerk from the Palestinian Authority. I don't know why. And I asked to stop representing the families, the Palestinian families. I try to figure why he go through this decision. I really did not get any answers.
Left with more questions than answers, the remaining 24 Palestinian families in Sheikh Jarrah face an uncertain future. Aya Batraoui, FSRN, Jerusalem.
And that wraps up today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kopp. Today's headlines editor was Jess Burns. Washington, D.C. editor was Leanne Caldwell. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley includes Rose Katapchi and Scott Pham. You can visit us online at fsrn.org. You can send questions, comments, or news tips to comments@fsrn.org. Thanks for listening. In New York, I'm Doreen Marina.